in the beginning, we were here, feeling the wind, smelling the sea, standing on this shore. All the things you take for granted most days, days when all you see is what you don't have. We had no idea where we would go, how we would leave the shore of Galilee and come back changed. I grew up here in Bethsaida. My parents named me Philip. It's a Greek name. The Greeks left their presence on our land. The name means lover of horses, but my life was about fish. And we worked hard at it in my village, every day, every night. But it was never enough. We were always hungry. Our clothes were always thin. Our houses were crowded. We fished at night, throwing our nets out on the Sea of Galilee and praying for God to bless us. In the morning, we sold our catch and went home and slept and stank. I grew up watching my mother feed us first when the fishing was poor. Whatever we had, she spread out among my siblings and me, and she went without. I hated that. My father used to say when we had enough, we'd buy our own boat, fish for ourselves. And we used to talk about what we would name that boat. It never happened. The guys in town said we just had to wait. When we were strong enough, we'd show everyone who put us down. Strong enough. Enough food, enough money, enough strength. I didn't know what enough was, but I wanted it. My father taught me about working hard, putting yourself second at least. He didn't complain. Never said that life should give him more than it had. But I always knew that he dreamed about more. I knew because of the way he attended to the scripture. My father couldn't read, but he hung on every word in the synagogue. It's how he made sense out of life, how he found hope for our future. "When the Messiah comes, son," he would say, "he'll lift us up. He'll put things right. Fish aren't going to matter anymore." Well, I guess I'm my father's son because I got hooked on this life of fishing and waiting. But what on this earth did we have to dream about, me and the guys I grew up with, Andrew, Simon? With Rome over Israel and most of Israel over us, we knew our lives would never amount to much unless we found this Messiah. So as a young man, I started hanging around the one they called John, the baptizer. He was one of those preachers your parents weren't sure about. A voice, he called himself, preparing the way for God's chosen one. John would say things like, "Among you stands one you do not know." I remember looking around and wondering, would I recognize this Messiah if I saw him? Luckily, I didn't have to. He came to me. One day I was mending a sail, trying to patch what had been patched 100 times before. And I saw a man coming towards me on the beach. He looked like one of us, about my age, my status. Strange thing is I didn't recognize him. And I knew just about everyone on this shoreline. He came right up to me, looked down and saw the patch and the sail, and it was like we had this whole conversation without saying a word. Like he saw not just the patch and the sail, but how futile it all felt. I felt like I should know him, but I was certain I'd never met him. "Follow me," he said, and something clicked. I heard John saying, "Among you stands one you do not know." And I got up fast and followed. His name was Jesus, the son of Joseph from Nazareth. The day before, he had picked up Simon and Andrew. They followed him around town all day until he finally turned around and spoke to them. But he had come to me. I always hung on to that. That afternoon, I went to my friend, Nathanael, who was also one of John's disciples, and said, I think we found him, Simon and Andrew and I. He could be the one. He's here in Galilee. It's Jesus from Nazareth. Nathanael was not so easily convinced. Nazareth, he said. Really? You think the Messiah is going to come from Nazareth? I couldn't explain why I was so drawn to this man, but I was certain that Nathanael would be too if he met him. Come and see, I said. And he did. And we became disciples. No, we had no idea what that meant or where it would lead. We'd only been with Jesus for about a week when we attended a wedding. We do big weddings in Galilee, and everyone was there. It was like a dozen other weddings I'd been to that year, until about halfway through the feast, a rumor began to circulate among the guests. Did you hear? They're out of wine. It wasn't even my wedding, and I froze. This would be my nightmare. Running out, not having enough. It would be humiliating for the hosts. How could they have let it happen? As the whispering died down, I noticed Jesus and his mother having a disagreement. As was traditional, his mother won. And with something like a sigh, Jesus gestured to some of the servants. And we watched as he told them to fill some stone jars with water. These were massive jars, and the servants poured water into them right up to the brim. Now, draw some out and bring it to the master of the feast, Jesus said. The servants looked at each other, wondering if they should do what he had just suggested. One of them gave a subtle shake of his head. But another one dipped a ladle into the liquid, drew some out, and brought it in a cup to the master of the feast, who hadn't seen any of this business with the jars and the water. The master sniffed the drink, took a sip, and smiled. He called for the groom. Most people bring out the best wine first and save the cheap stuff till later. But you have brought the best wine out now. He raised his cup in a toast. Everyone cheered. Cups were filled and the party went on. Now, only a few of us had seen what happened. What had Jesus done and how? I looked over at his mother and she just kind of smiled and walked off to join the dancing. Well, that party went on long into the night. They never ran out of wine. People talked about that wedding for months. I still wasn't sure what Jesus had done and why. But when he turned that water into wine, he'd made a statement. And he'd made more than enough. From then on, we were just along for a ride. And it was the ride of our lives. Jesus wasn't looking to us for directions. He always seemed to know exactly what to do next, who to spend time with. And honestly, his ideas were always completely different from ours, which was fine with me. We needed new ideas. We needed a new way. It turned out a lot of people thought so, because as the months went by, more and more people began following Jesus. And I mean following him. There was no getting away from them. No matter where we spent the night, they would find out and be waiting for us in the morning. And they needed things. They wanted things. Many of them were desperate for healing. They'd heard what Jesus had done. People brought their friends, their parents, their children. It was amazing. But it was also heartbreaking, overwhelming. The neediness of people, of all of us. It could be crushing at times. Only Jesus seemed to have the strength to get up and keep doing it day after day. But even he could get tired. And the day we heard that John the Baptizer was dead, it shook us all. I felt sick. I could remember following him around Galilee just a short time ago. Well, Jesus was troubled too. He wanted some space to think and pray. So he got in the boats and went to the far side of Galilee, a remote place. But even there, the crowds followed. We looked back and saw this great swarm coming towards us. Was there no getting away from these people? I let out a sigh, and Jesus heard me. And he gave me that look. That look that meant he knew what I was thinking. That he knew something I didn't know. It happened a lot, actually. He waved me over. "Philip," he said, "where are we going to buy some bread to give all these people something to eat?" Jesus always knew how to push you. When he asked me that, I tensed up on the inside. Bread? Out here in the middle of nowhere? For all these people? There had to be thousands of them. They were like a great flock of aimless sheep. And it was just like Jesus to want to take care of them all. 200 denarii wouldn't buy each of them a bite, I said. A half a year's wages couldn't feed all these people. Come on, Jesus. Hey, I didn't want anyone to go hungry. I knew what that felt like. I just felt helpless. Another situation in which I didn't have enough. I wasn't enough. Well, meanwhile, Andrew had been moving among the crowd, and he came back with a small boy, a fisherman's kid by the smell of him, scrawny, but well cared for. You could see it. His tunic was carefully mended. His mother had packed him a small parcel of food, and he held it out with his hands. "This kid here's got 5 barley loaves and a couple of fish," Andrew announced. I looked at him like he was crazy. "Hey, it's what we've got," he said. Well, Jesus took it, the kid's lunch. He prayed over it, and then had us start breaking up the bread and passing it out to people, cutting up the fish and giving people a bite. At first, I was breaking off these tiny pieces of bread, hardly a crumb. But no matter how much I broke off, there always seemed to be more. It made no sense. And suddenly, I remembered that night at the wedding, servants pouring water into empty jars. And when I realized we weren't running out, I became generous. "How much do you want?" I said. "We have plenty." In the end, I walked back to Jesus, bread still in my hands. I asked if he was hungry. He shook his head. "Gather up the leftovers," he said, "so nothing goes to waste." The leftovers. There it was again. More than enough. The others started gathering up baskets and filling them. I just stood there. Jesus came and put a hand on my shoulder, as if to say, "Do you get it now, Philip?" I didn't know what to say. The next day, Jesus was still talking about bread. The crowds had come back. They were hoping for more food. "This isn't the food you want," Jesus was saying. "Don't spend your lives working for bread that rots or runs out. The bread of God is the one who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world." Well, no one understood what he meant, but they said anyway, "Yes, we want this bread. Where can we get it?" "I am the bread of life," he said. "Whoever comes to me will neither hunger nor thirst." Well, apparently, I wasn't the only one confused, but people began to grumble. This wasn't what they'd come out for. As they left, we heard them muttering, calls himself the bread of heaven, as if we don't know who his parents are. But even as they walked away, Jesus kept talking. I am the bread of life, he said. And the bread I give for the life of the world is my own body and my own blood for drink. Your fathers ate bread and died. Whoever eats my bread will live forever. Well, there were times I wished the crowd would go away, and now they did. The longer Jesus talked, the more of them left. Even some who'd been with us for many months turned their backs and walked away. The 12 of us stood there behind him silently, exchanging glances. Finally, everyone was gone but us. Jesus turned around and looked at each one of us, looked at me. There was hurt in his eyes. Do you also want to leave? The road was right there. I knew where it led. Your fathers ate bread and died, I heard him say. That was the life I knew. But I heard my father say, fish aren't going to matter anymore. And that was the life I wanted. And I still believed that Jesus knew the way. Finally, Peter opened his mouth. I don't always agree with Peter, but he spoke for all of us this time. Lord, where else would we go? So we stayed. Us with him and Jesus with us. The crowds came back too, especially after he called that man out of the tomb in Bethany. With every miracle Jesus performed, the stakes got higher. By the time we arrived in Jerusalem a week or so ago, the people were in a frenzy. They threw coats on the road in front of us, waved palm branches. Hosanna, Lord, save us, they said. I remember thinking, I wish my father could see this. This was it. It had to be. People were calling Jesus their King of Israel. Well, some people were. Others wanted him dead. Later that week, we celebrated the Passover in a room Jesus had quietly rented. We were keeping a low profile since the Lazarus incident. We knew the authorities were looking for any excuse to arrest him. Jesus knew it too. He kept talking about dying, about one of us betraying him. That mood of triumph when he entered into the city had completely evaporated. Everyone was jumpy. That's how it was around the table that night. Jesus kept talking about going away. Where I am going, you cannot come, he said. You can't follow me now, but later. Why? Peter asked. And we all wanted to know. After being with Jesus, we couldn't imagine being without him. Oh, we could go back, we could do our jobs, raise our families, fish. But without Jesus, it wouldn't have felt like life. And now he's talking about leaving, and all those anxious thoughts came back. Was he leaving because of us? Because we weren't good enough? Was he looking for better disciples? In my father's house are many rooms, he said. You know the way to the place I'm going. In my father's house, there's one room. I didn't know what Jesus was saying, nor did anyone else. Lord, Thomas said, we don't know where you're going, so how can we know the way? And Jesus said, I am the way and the truth and the life. If you knew me, you would know my Father. In fact, you do know him and have seen him. His Father, well, I knew he wasn't talking about Joseph, the carpenter from Nazareth. He was talking about God, the Father of us all. But how could he say we had seen him? How could he be the way? And I just sensed in my gut he was leaving, and I panicked. Lord, show us the Father, and that will be enough. A little more proof, a little more assurance. Enough. That's all I ever wanted. But the moment the words left my mouth, I regretted them. He looked at me the way he'd looked at me the day we fed the crowd with the bread, the day he first found me in Galilee. Have I been with you all this time, Philip, and you still don't know who I am? That question haunted me for the next 3 days. Do you still not know who I am? Because that night he was arrested. He was betrayed by one of us. And just as he had predicted, just as we had feared, he died at the hands of people who had everything I once thought I wanted, money and power and status. But it wasn't enough for them. On Sunday, it looked like everything was coming together. And by Friday, it had all fallen apart. We fell apart as soon as he was gone. Even on our best day, all of us didn't add up to one of him. Without Jesus, we had nothing. After he died, some of the guys regretted what they hadn't asked him. They wished they'd asked him to tell them more about the kingdom, more parables, more wisdom. But my regret was what I hadn't told him. Do you still not know who I am, Philip? The thing is, I did know, and I didn't say. I didn't say, you are the one who found me. You are the shepherd who put himself between the sheep and the wolf. You are the true vine that made us all grow. You are the light in the dark corners of my life. You are the bread that never runs out. You are the way to the Father. You are true. And being with you is life itself. Jesus, you are enough. I did know who he was. I'd known it since Galilee. I just wish it hadn't taken his death for me to finally say it. And now I'd missed my chance. Would it have made a difference if I said it that night around the table? I don't know. But my silence followed me, dragging behind all the things I'd always believed about myself. That I wasn't smart enough or brave enough or quick enough. But I guess Jesus already knew all that. But Jesus knew something else. Something we didn't know. That's how it always was with Jesus. There was always more to the story. Something you didn't see coming. And that's what happened next. On the first day of that new week, some of our friends went out to visit Jesus' tomb. On their way, the earth shook. And when they got there, they found someone, an angel, waiting for them, who'd rolled away the stone like it was nothing, sat on top of it like it's something you do every day. Don't be afraid, the angel said. You're looking for Jesus who was crucified. He isn't here. He's risen. See for yourselves. Then go tell his disciples. He'll meet them in Galilee. He had left because of us, because he loved us. And he'd come back because of us, to show us once and for all that if we have him, we don't need anything else. But why Galilee? I didn't understand that at first. Jerusalem is where everything important happens. If he really had come back from the dead, if he'd proven himself, Jerusalem would be the place to make a statement. What did we have in Galilee? Except empty jars and loaves of bread and fish. That first night back in Galilee, we didn't know what to do with ourselves. So we went fishing. Peter's suggestion. Spent the whole night out on the lake. and caught absolutely nothing. Just like old times. But as dawn was breaking, a stranger on shore called to us. "Throw your nets on the other side of the boat," he said. It made no sense, but we did it anyway. And we caught so many fish, it nearly sank the boat. It was a statement. It was more than enough, and we knew it was him. So here I am, because I believe that the place where it all began is the place it will begin again. Jesus can do more with the simple pieces of our lives than we ever imagined. In this life that never seemed like enough, I think it might surprise me. In going to the grave and coming back again, Jesus made a way for us to live a new kind of life. With him, always. Whatever we've done or haven't done, what he did is enough. My father got a lot of things right about the Messiah. But one thing I think he missed. I'm pretty sure there are more fish in our future.